and to support students with disabilities, and we have a real treat today. My name is Tara Kintz, and I work with the Michigan Assessment Consortium. I have a background, I'm in teaching, working as an instructional coach, an administrator, teaching at MSU in educational administration. But my first job before I taught and moved into other roles was as a special education teacher and at the elementary level. And that was near and dear to my heart because it was really formative in my way of thinking about working and supporting students. So I'm thrilled to be here today with you, with my amazing colleagues. Cheryl is flown in to join us today and an expert in this work.
Well, thank you, Tara. I'm Cheryl Lazarus, and I'm the Director Emeritus of the National Center on Educational Outcomes, NCEL. NCEL's focus is on the inclusion of students with disabilities as well as English learners in assessment. And I've considered myself so fortunate. It's a real honor to be working with these experts here in Michigan with FAME on some resources on inclusion of students with disabilities in formative assessment.
I'm Christy Walters, and I work at Corona Public Schools. I'm also on the FAME leadership team for formative assessment for Michigan educators. And I have, my background is in special education, and I work.
Where is that lesson plan? I swear it was right here.
Maybe before you search for your plan, you could search for the treasures.
Students bring treasure chests of skills and life experiences to the classroom.
So the stuff they already know, what they bring with them before they walk through my door.
Exactly. Students bring a treasure trove of things with them into a classroom that teachers can and should consider as they craft their lessons.
Students engage more when their backgrounds show up in what they learn. When they have the opportunity to share their own knowledge and interests.
So I'm not just teaching from my own perspective?
Nope. You and your students work together to establish a sense of understanding of the discipline. Teachers can surface students' funds of knowledge by treating the classroom like a curiosity lab, constantly collecting clues about what learners already know from home, community, culture, hobbies, and lived experience. We identify students' funds of knowledge through writing, conversations, class projects, and even conversations with parents, guardians, siblings, and friends.
So this matrix is basically a set of trading cards for each student, only instead of stats and features, it lists all the strengths, experiences, talents, and backgrounds they bring into our classroom.
Exactly. Think about this option for a moment. You learn that one of your students and their family makes kimchi. Might this be a perfect opportunity for your student to show your class how to do this, as you all work to learn about fermentation?
That's a great way to connect a student's life to a lesson. I can only imagine how students might be more engaged in the classroom.
Yes, it's eye-opening. Another example I just thought of comes from one of our colleagues in the elementary school. At conferences, Ms. Crampton learned that one of her students started a lawn mowing business where she mows for two families in her neighborhood.
Ms. Crampton decided to pivot her lesson on tracking personal responsibilities to add instruction and discussions about how students can budget any money they may earn outside of school.
Thanks for sharing. I cannot believe I was leaving out my students' funds of knowledge during the planning process. The real treasure isn't my missing lesson plan. It is what my students bring to my classroom.
You've got that right.
If you want to wind up your conversation, we'll pull back together in 30 seconds or so. Okay, let's pull back together. Would one or two of you be willing to share what you discussed?
I think I just kind of focused on, I really liked when you talked about having a vision for like high expectations for all learners, but what our problem in with a lot of districts that I work with is that the mindset is still not all students are general education students first, whether they have IEPs or Section 504 or have trauma or ELL learners, like they're still not considered all general education students. So it's that like almost district level, administrative level mindset that we're still struggling with, and it's not trickling all the way down. So that's been a barrier.
Anyone have any successes that could help with that mindset of that not all kids, not having high expectations for some kids? Oh dear. I was, oh, John has, thank goodness John has something.
I didn't think it at the time, but when I went through my student teaching back in the early 90s, I was in a program or in a school that was very progressive for its time. It was a school that was really promoting inclusion and co-taught classrooms. It wasn't what you often see today where this class is co-taught. Here's the teacher, here's the special ed teacher who's a glorified aide, and maybe they provide some supports and scaffolding. It was true co-teaching. And the leadership drove that. They went from a pilot to a full implementation after I left. And it was the leadership of the school that drove that message and the tone. And I think that really led to the success, because it wasn't, we have an inclusive school where we have students that are, with disabilities that are alongside of students without disabilities. It was, this is our school, this is our culture. We happen to have many classrooms that are taught by two teachers. But that's a long time ago.
Though I think it's still, I know, it still happens. The school leaders just play such a key role in what the culture of a school, and really helping them to grow as school leaders who recognize the value of all their students. I think recognizing how the formative assessment process really, really, really can support and encourage the learning of some of the students who may be more difficult to successfully instruct. And I'm going to ask Mary Helen. Yeah, Mary Helen had a great example yesterday.
So at one point in my teaching career, I was primarily secondary with high school, and I was in middle school for a hot minute. And so the example I want to share with you is changing the mindset to understand that every kid brings assets to the table. And so in this particular eighth grade class, I was teaching five U.S. history classes. There were three eighth grade teachers. I had 54% of the students with IEPs, and the other two teachers had maybe less than 24% of the students with IEPs. And in this, my coworker, who at the time was a librarian, who also had a special needs daughter, who was very invested in helping especially the special ed kids, the students with disabilities, as well as with technology. And we teamed up, and in this particular semester, we had so many, I think it was something like 6 or 8 units for the semester, and for the card marking, there were maybe like 3 or 4 units in the card marking. And in it, we put the kids into different groups, and they were given different options of how they could do their summative when we were implementing technology. So it could have been like digital posters or PowerPoints or movies. There was all these different options. And they all had the same learning standards and what the content had to include. But in the first card marking, we put the students with disabilities in in their own groups so that we could work with them specifically. Well, lo and behold, the only kids who tried doing the movie, which was like deemed the hardest by all the kids, were the special ed kids, because we were like, we are going to make sure these kids know how to make a movie. And in that first card marking, the only kids who did that movie were the special ed kids, and it blew the whole class away. Well, then in the second card marking, we integrated everybody into different groups, and lo and behold, the special ed kids were the ones teaching their peers how to do the movies. And all of a sudden, what we were noticing is that all these kids who were, you know, previously, oh, they're the kids, the special ed kids, they were like standing up taller, their shoulders were back, their heads were held high. And all of a sudden, there was those barriers that John and I were talking about, those differences were erased. Because all of a sudden, their peers were going, I can learn something from my colleague. Well, from my friend. And it was just something where it just elevated everybody. But it was changing that mindset so that it's an asset-based. And it was giving everybody an opportunity. And technology was a great equalizer because it put everybody kind of on that same playing field. And yeah, did those kids get a lot of support from us in that first card marking to really kind of guide them through that? Sure. But then were they able to take that information and train their peers? Absolutely. And they became the experts. And all of a sudden, now there was this even playing field. And everybody wanted to work together. And then in the second semester, we just took off. Like, it was fantastic. So that was just something where you're changing the value system and the mindset of people first and giving those kids opportunities to build those wins that Tara was talking about and getting on those winning streaks. Is that helpful?
Oh, definitely. I love that example. It's a wonderful example. Thank you. And now I'm going to turn it over to Christy, who I think has a few more examples.
Yes, thank you.
All right. I am at a district where we have full inclusion, and it is not a utopia. There are definitely classrooms, I would say, especially the higher up you go, that more have the special ed teacher as the second person in there that might be a glorified aide. Those special ed teachers might not know how to teach Algebra 2, and they're in an Algebra 2 co-taught class, and they're in there learning it right along with the kids and doing their best to provide specially designed instruction. But at our lowest levels, I would say that's the closest we get to a utopia. We have a preschool director who supports completely full inclusion. She does not allow our ancillary services to pull kids out, so they have to get their PT, OT, social work services right in the classroom. Other kids are allowed to engage with them when they're doing their strategies. She believes that our students who are most severely impacted, so I can think right now, currently in our preschool program, we have a student who's probably going to, when they turn 6 and can no longer be in that program, have to go to a severely multiply impaired classroom. But she recognizes that child is going to be there till they're 26 years old, and she wants that child to be around their typically developing peers for as absolutely long as possible. Because even though that child can't speak, they can't walk, they can't feed themselves, they have a right to be with their typically developing peers, to play, to laugh, to engage. So I am in a space where we have that kind of leadership. We have the kind of leadership that allows me to be an advocate and to say, it's not about can they, it's about how can they. How can we make this happen? But I'm not going to lie to you and tell you that it sounds like John's student teaching experience, because the higher up we go, I would say it sounds less and less like that, but we still continue to have students. And I graduated from the high school where I teach, or the district where I teach, and I can tell you I didn't even know that special ed was a thing until I went through my special ed program. And honestly, when I went to do my student teaching, so I had finished the 4 years, all I thought was of programs. Like, I thought what we were talking about, even though I got my certification in learning students with learning disabilities, I still thought they were talking about that program, because in my senior year, I was in a moderately cognitively impaired classroom working with students on my lunch period. So that's what I thought we were talking about. When I did my student teaching and I went back to my former district, I was like, wait a second, what? They were just in my class? Like, I didn't even know. So I think we do an okay job. Plenty of room to learn. But I want to share with you, how do we advocate for students? And I will tell you that I think the silver bullet is clarity. And I just want to show you some examples. So if you have an opportunity to look at that learning point, I want to take the example. We did a classroom example in that learning point. Cheryl's the main author on it, but Tara and I were able to provide some examples in that learning point. And the learning target is something I was just doing in an earlier presentation, so I'm not going to get on my soapbox for too long, but I do get kind of passionate and then I talk kind of fast. But always thinking about what is the ultimate goal? And sometimes it takes the five whys. So why do we want students to know this? Well, why is that important? Well, why is that important? Well, why are they going to need to do that? Because we need to really get at what is it that we want all students to have the opportunity to know and be able to do. And then we have that success criteria. We get really clear about how are we going to know. And it doesn't need to look the same for every student, because we can ask ourselves, when we're really clear about what it is they need to know and be able to do, we can get really clear about, is that really the only way? Is that really the only way they could show us? And I want to go through some examples of where I've asked myself, is that really the only way? So the standard that's in the learning point is to apply the area and perimeter formulas for rectangles in real world and mathematical problems. It's a fourth grade standard. And so here's the think aloud. This is what I, when I was proposing this idea to Cheryl and Tara, why do people need to know this? Well, there are some practical areas, paint, carpet, sports fields for area. So for perimeter, ribbons, fencing, property lines, the old standby garden fence, right? That shows up in all of the different assessments. And what does this connect to? What will students have already learned that we can build off from? Well, it's arrays and it's linear measurements. And then what does it prepare students for? Getting at that why. Why do they need to know this? This isn't just a skill in isolation, but they need to know this so that they can do more advanced geometric thinking later on, so that they can solve problems. So from all of that think aloud, that why do they need to? What do they already know? What will they need to use this for? Where does this apply in real life? We can get to that learning target that students will apply their understanding of area and perimeter to solve real world problems. Now, every student can't do this with fractions. Not every student can do this with rational numbers, but all students can do this skill. So from that, thinking about what is the success criteria, and again, another think aloud. So what are all the things that I would see in students who are able to apply their understanding of area and perimeter to solve real-world problems? Well, they have to be able to measure the sides of a rectangle. And not every student can do that in the same way, but they all can do that. They need to be able to calculate area. They need to be able to calculate perimeter. They need to be able to have an experience with models. We have to be open to thinking about how students might access these different things. And we have to be open to the conversation that they're having when they're able to experience these different skills. So here's an example where I took that success criteria, measure the sides of a rectangle. Actually, I skipped over the beginning here. So students should be doing 90% of the work. I fully believe that. We've got to get students doing the doing, because the person doing the doing is the person doing the learning, right? And then from the think point, students with disabilities, like all students, doesn't matter what students, they benefit when they're engaged. So this first picture here is actually a picture I took. I have a student in my district. He just recently had a heart transplant. He was born, right after he was born, he had a stroke. And there were some things that he really struggled with, and one of them was being able to use a ruler. The ruler, because the left side of his body doesn't work very well, and he needed to be able to hold the paper to be able to measure, he really struggled to get that ruler where he needed it to go. So how do we fix that? We put a heavy lead weight in the middle of the ruler, so now it has a lot more friction, traction, so that he could push that ruler along, and it also stuck up a little bit like a handle for him. How could he use that protractor? Just simple. We just took a spool of thread, and we glued it to the protractor so that he could be able to manipulate it a little bit more easily. Now he has access. Some of those students who still wouldn't be able to do it, put it on grid paper. They can count up how many, what the area of that is, what the perimeter is, now that they see it on grid paper. Some kids just need a clear ruler. They might not be able to line it up with that wooden ruler because now they can't see the line because it's a little over because their fine motor skills aren't great. Give them a clear one. Tactile rulers, magnifying glasses, all students can do this, right? Maybe the shapes need to be just a little bit bigger. Then we think about the other one of the other success criteria, comparing rectangles with the same perimeter in different areas and the same area in different perimeters, to talk about when would it make sense to have something long and skinny versus short and fat, right? Some kids are going to be motivated by Cheez-Its, and those are squares, and they can build area and perimeter with those Cheez-Its, and then despite the fact that they have probably not washed their hands in days, they're going to eat those Cheez-Its. It's going to freak me out. But we've got kids that want to just use those blocks, right? They can do this. Give them 12 blocks. How many different ways can they make area and perimeter with those 12 blocks? Or we can put it on grid paper. All students can do this work. They don't all have to do it with fractions. They don't all have to do it with negative numbers and thinking abstractly. We can find a way for all students to have independent access when we get really clear about what the goal is. So I'm not going to read this to you, but walking around and observing students, having some questions in your back pocket to really get at what are they thinking. When you see that students are finding the perimeter of a rectangle, you're asking them, hey, what do all those numbers that you wrote down represent? Can they tell you those are the side lengths? What are they thinking about there? Why are you adding those numbers? What does that do for you? Right? Whether they're doing it right or they're doing it wrong, getting at their thinking, letting them have an opportunity to talk with one another, giving students an opportunity to give feedback to one another. So the idea here in the Think Point is that they're working in small groups and they've got enough examples that every student gets an opportunity to be the lead. So you set it up so that only one student can touch the materials per problem, so that every student has to take turns using the materials to find the perimeter. Only one student can access the calculator per problem, so they have to switch who that is, so that they're all taking turns and being equally engaged. And what are they noticing about one another? I noticed when you were calculating, you did this. And how do they self-assess? How are they talking about what they had the opportunity to learn? This is going to be a little bit of a tangent, but just listening to the kids is so impactful, and you learn so much about them, and you have to be ready with these questions, and you have to be ready for whatever their answers are. Last year, I was working, or I think it was 2 years ago now, I was working with a group of students on volume. And I wanted to activate their background knowledge, figure out their funds of knowledge, what was their experience with volume. So I built some shapes out of unit cubes, because that's the fifth grade standard. Volume is just with unit cubes. And I set the figure in front of them, and I said, okay, talk with your partners about how many unit cubes are in this rectangular prism. And they disagreed on how many there were. And the reason they disagreed is because some students were adamant that it was the volume was going to be the number of cubes they could count and see. And they were those multicolored ones, so they were a little bit easier to count because they weren't all the same color. And some of the students were absolutely adamant that there were no little cubes inside the middle of that rectangular prism. So then we talked about how, kind of blew my mind, because how were they thinking those ones in the middle stood up at the top if there was nothing holding them up in the bottom? They were adamant that they could figure out a way to make those ones at the top float there. And after they took it apart and put it back together, they realized, oh, volume is about what's in the middle too. You have to be ready. You have to listen. You have to be curious about what their thinking is. Having some questions prepared to help you do that. So then you're using those observational and anecdotal notes. You're thinking about how do you help students, how do you show them models, how do you ask them questions, how do you determine what group students need to be in, using their questions and their wonderings to figure out where are they at in their learning right now, how is this important to them, what scenarios are they coming up with, and then asking students to be able to set goals for themselves and reflect on their learning. So that was the example from the Think Point. Just a couple of other examples. I was recently working with a group of teachers, and they're working on phonological awareness for students, and the students don't have speech skills. And I'm like, well, phonological awareness isn't about speech skills. We can still figure out whether or not the students can manipulate these vowel sounds in the middle of words. So the idea here is that they wanted to know, say Pat. Well, the student couldn't say Pat. But say Pat, now change the a to an I, and the word is. And the student didn't have the skills to be able to manipulate those sounds verbally, but they could point to a picture. Now what is the word? Is this the word? I can't say it. Is this the word? Is this the word? Is this the word? Were they just changing the initial sound, right? Some discriminating things. But students can tell us what they know when we meet them where they are. I also am working with a student right now. He has a cognitive impairment, and he has a speech impediment, so he can't do things like speech to text to be able to write his writing pieces. But when I get really clear with the teacher about what it is that the student needs to be able to do, how else can we determine whether or not that student can do that? What the learning target here was that the student was going to have to talk about organizing information and facts in an informational essay. Most students are going to write the essay. That's not the only way to organize facts. When you get really clear, that was the point. The point wasn't to write an essay, it was to organize facts. But could this student find information in a text? Could they highlight it? Could they highlight it in different colors to show how the information goes into different categories? Could you provide the student with different types of information and they categorize it by cutting and pasting? We can find ways when we get really clear about what it is that we want students to know and be able to do. And then I talked about this in an earlier session today, if you happen to be there, but just this idea that the context doesn't have to drive the learning. We can brainstorm. Are there similar contexts or contexts that are in the student's area of preferred interest that would get them motivated? When you get really clear that this learning target here is not about analyzing the data and statistics from the Detroit Lions 2025 season to make recommendations for the 2026 draft, it's about analyzing data in order to make a recommendation. So how do we find ways to get students, give students the opportunity to demonstrate that learning in a different way? Brainstorming. Are there similar data sets? Are there statistical figures? How much does the context really matter here? Getting really clear so that we can provide students with opportunities. Getting clear about what counts. Here are some questions to metacognitively put yourself into conflict with what you currently believe students have to do to demonstrate their learning. Is your success criteria too narrow? Do they all have to write an essay? Do they all have to be able to verbalize those different phonemes? Is the context important? How well do they understand the learning target and the success criteria? How can they have a say or some agency in what it is that they do? So again, these are here if you download this. Just questions that would be beneficial, I think, for you to ask yourself as you're planning for instruction for all students, not just students with disabilities. Formative feedback. What do students need in order to be able to self-assess? Asking yourself this. How might students best access that feedback? If they can't read, don't write the feedback on their paper, right? You need to have a conversation with them. How beneficial is it going to be if it comes after they're already done? They're not going to be willing to redo the assignment. When is that feedback appropriate? How is that feedback appropriate? How are they going to access it? How are they going to use it? What questions might help me probe deeper with students? And then getting clear about those instructional decisions that you have to make. What are you really looking for today? Does it have to all be done in one way? Do you have to take something home, or can you question students while they're in class? Can you just listen in on their conversation? How might you group students? How do you make sure that all students are participating? How do you make the group small enough that all students are required to participate? Or how do you stack the deck so that all students have to participate? I recently did something with a group of adults, and I made it so that the cards where they had to talk about certain things, they were doing some dialogic learning exercises, and they were different colors, and you could only talk about the cards that were in your color. Everyone has to participate. Everyone plays a role. I was in a session yesterday, and Ellen was talking about how data walls can shame kids. Their names might not be up on that data wall, but they know where they are on that data wall. And you've got that up, and you want to see how many of the kids are at what percent. And what if that data wall instead was us working together as a team, because everyone in this classroom needs to learn this? And what if our data wall told us what percentage of kids in this classroom could do it? Because it's all of our responsibility to make sure all students in this classroom can learn. And when you're in a group with other students, it's not for you to just get the task done, but it's for you to make sure that everyone in your group understands. How do you give them a chance? How do you question them? How do you give them feedback? What if our data wall showed that 85% of our students in this class could do it because we worked together? How different would that culture be? So in summary, doing less of listening for correctness. As the teacher, do less talking. You've got to talk a little bit. You've got to give them something to talk about. You've got to give them things to think about, but you shouldn't be doing the majority of the talking. Less worksheets, less assuming. Why assume when you can just ask them? Less planning what you're going to do, more planning what they're going to do. Less evaluating, more opportunities for feedback. More listening to kids. And then just going back to this graphic, and I'm going to turn it back over to Tara, just this idea that there's not one pathway to get there, and I think the key to this is clarity, because once you have clarity, you can differentiate for students so that they can be as independent and as successful as possible, and we don't lower the bar. We can't lower the bar because they deserve better than that. So Tara, you had something you wanted to share?
Excellent. Thank you so much, Christy. So helpful to have the examples to help us really start to say, how can this look? And I think Cheryl pointed to something really helpful when she said, you know, the teachers who are coming in together, it's really a co-partnership. And just as much as the students are partners in that learning experience, both educators coming together are these equal partners. And I think that's such a difference. I think you pointed to that too, right? Of when educators are collaborating together to support those student needs. I want to share with you that the CEC has developed high leverage practices for working with students with disabilities. And we are working right now on a crosswalk, thank you for the input from John and also from Cheryl, of really matching up what are those high leverage practices and how do those map on to the formative assessment process. And we see a lot of parallels in those. And so right now we're kind of parsing out, but what we're seeing is it's not another thing. These practices are what we have seen. That's where the formative assessment process came about. It was a body of research that really looked at what are practices that are really helping advance student learning, and we put it into a framework that had these different components and elements. But all that comes down to is research of what helps students learn, all students. And when you see Christy's examples, she's just getting at how are we really clear, we being the teacher and the student, of where are we going? What is it that we're trying to do? And it's not just activity-based. And I have to say, my kids come home and they write like their goals for the week of like their learning goals, and it's like, I'll memorize my biography. And I said to my daughter, I was like, Mira, that's an activity, but what are you learning, you know? And I think this is the push so much to what is this language of learning? And how do we really parse down our own focus on what's really meaningful in this learning experiences for all students? Because when you get there, it can be demonstrated in so many different ways, but really what is meaningful? And we as human beings, we know when something is valuable and when it's meaningful and authentic and it's driving learning versus when it's busy work or it's irrelevant. And so the more as teachers we can do that, the more students will call for it and say, what are we learning? What am I supposed to learn? How am I showing you what I'm learning? And I went on a school tour last month and the principal walked me around. It was the first time I'd seen an administrator not interact with the teachers, but only interact with the students when they walked into the classroom. And they walked in the classroom, they said hello, and then they went to the student and said, what are you learning? And I almost fell back. I was so impressed to hear this administrator, and I think that's how we can do it, for all students to know wherever you are in your learning, that your learning is important, and how are you showing your learning, and how are you a demand for that learning, and that you have all these assets that you're bringing to help leverage, because that's the hardwire for them to make sense of new learning that's coming in. So that is, I think, a nugget of the work that we were working at. We're also working at a going deeper guide. So beyond this think point, it's kind of a guide that touches on some of these ideas. So we really look forward to hearing your feedback today of what connections are you making? What are you pondering? What's a takeaway that you're thinking about for your context? And then how is the thinking that we're bringing today deepening where you're going next with your own learning and supporting the learning of others? So take a minute again with that colleague that you spoke with earlier and just reflect on your key takeaways and your own learning for today. Finishing up your idea. I'm gonna wrap up. and coming back together. I'm so glad you had so many ideas to share with each other. It would be wonderful to get to hear a few of your thoughts of maybe what you thought, what is lingering for you or what stood out for you. Who might like to share with us? Clearly, we could keep talking. From back here, highlights, anything we'd love to hear from you.
Was that the whole idea that every student is our student. It's not just this is a special ed thing or this is a gen ed thing. It has to start with the administration and come down. And I've noticed when we've had at my school, and I've seen it in other schools too, when it's been a change in an administrator, all of a sudden you start seeing the teachers backslide into, oh, special ed, you take this child. And I'm like, but this is your kid too. And I think that's the hardest part to get across. But I was just telling them that I taught in juvenile detention my first few years of teaching. So I know every single cuss word. I know what not to drive to get it stolen and all of the good things. But no matter what, it was my kid. I don't care if it was an IEP accommodation or when I ended up writing their IEPs. It was my kid. I could not just pass them off to somebody else. And I think that's the part that many general ed teachers have to know and get the agency from their administration to do what's right for assessing the students.
So well said. Thank you for sharing that. And how important it is to come from every level, right? And you brought it from your level, from where you were. You said, okay, this is going to be how it's going to go. One more person who might want to share? Yes, please, Shannon.
So I'm thinking about, Christy, your earlier session too about learning targets and success criteria and how in CoLab classes, like clarity of the learning target and success criteria is really essential for the special ed teacher too. Like, and when kids are going, like they might be in a collaborative class, but then have time with their special ed case manager to like work on things. And if that case manager doesn't know the success criteria, they cannot provide as much scaffolding and support. So that clarity is really important for everyone involved in the learning.
Thank you. That's such a huge piece and such an important part. We've come to the end of our afternoon, and I hope you had an absolutely fabulous conference. I hope that this session gave you some things and connections to bring it all together, and I hope you travel really safely wherever you go. Thank you for spending the time with us today. Here's our contact information. We are resources to you for any way we can support your work, and look forward to seeing you again. Thank you.